Ajahn Sumedho was the very first Westerner that Ajahn Chah trained, might even have been the very first Westerner he'd ever met. In 1967, he was, through various fortuitous circumstances, had been a novice in the northeast of Thailand for a year, after having left Berkeley in the early 60s, just as it was starting to get extremely interesting. He realized it was getting too interesting for his own safety, so he joined the Peace Corps and went to Asia to pursue his interests in Asian life and meditation. And after a year as a novice, was introduced to Venerable Ajahn Chah and experienced an immediate affinity with him. And since that time, many others have come under not only Ajahn Chah's influence, but Ajahn Sumedho's influence. He is resident in England at Amaravati Monastery, and is the spiritual head, father of numerous branch monasteries around the world. In this country, Abhayagiri Monastery, also in Europe and in the Antipodes. And so he is American by birth and has been coming over here to the States for many years, often on the invitation of Jack Kornfield, with whom he was a monk in the 60s at Ajahn Chah's monastery. But more recently, since our Abhayagiri has been established, we've been inviting him over to teach here also. And he's just finished doing a couple of retreats at Spirit Rock. The first was a 10-day retreat for the general public, and then the second was a five-day session with the Spirit Rock teachers. They decided whenever they gathered together, they did too much talking with each other and didn't stay in silence enough, and so they thought, well, we need some to create occasions when we have retreats together. And they had the inspiration to ask if Ajahn Sumedho would lead the first such session for them. And we just finished that yesterday. Yesterday. So I think probably the influence of that will be spreading through the Bay Area and around the country for a long time to come. I think the teachers were fairly stunned by how much they were changed and illumined by the teachings at that time. So I'd like to invite Ajahn Sumedho now to give his own reflections.
Thank you. this is indeed a wonderful occasion to see kind of reunion of many of friends that have all come here for this special event around the life and times of Ajahn Chah. And this is, of course, he was the great inspiration, a living inspiration for me, because when I was a student at Berkeley, this is in about 1962-63, I was very much inspired by Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. I was in an Asian studies program for an MA, and at the time, and I felt my life was really, I was terribly disappointed with my life as I was living it then, and this Gandhi figure was somebody I could relate to, somebody that I had heard of in my lifetime. He wasn't like somebody, some ancient sage of the past, but an actually living human being who had died during my lifetime. So Ajahn Chah when I met him, he was a living example to me of wisdom and humility and love. And I think when I look back, I stayed with him for 10 years, and I realized that it was this sense of being loved. He had a tremendous sense of acceptance, and it was unconditional. So I think this was the first time I really experienced that from another human individual. And also, he was like a role model, a figure, a male figure that I could trust and who was seemed to respect me and was very welcoming. And so the 10 years that I lived with him were, I think, it was a transition years from very kind of unhappy, disappointed person to someone who had increasingly more confidence and a direction and had really learned, tried to learn, and had learned a lot from living as a Buddhist monk during those 10 years with Lungpho Cha. And he also had this, he made sense out of monasticism for me. And as you can see, the monks here, he's one of those rare Buddhist monks in the world who actually inspired us to become monks and to live as monks and to practice as Buddhist monks. Where at the time, before I met him, there were many Westerners going to Asian countries, to especially to Thailand or Sri Lanka. In those days, Burma was a closed door to us. But so many of them didn't have a sense of Sangha or valued this sense of being a Sangha of monks or the value of the Vinaya discipline. So the interest that many of us had in Buddhism was in the Dhamma and the practice and the meditation. And so this was the reason why I went. I didn't actually go to become a monk or to learn the discipline. And so when I met Ajahn Chah, I felt he made sense out of the whole life of a Buddhist monk, because his approach was hands-on and very practical way of dealing with the problems of being human and living together in a community of other monks who we all kind of committed in our way to this discipline, which is our way of relating physically and verbally to each other and with the material world and the society that we live in. But also, it gave us a chance to live together and learn and practice in a trusting community where a level of this trust was engendered just through the common agreements that we had with our Vinaya discipline. I think with any Westerner, we're so full of ourselves when we go, and we, you know, we want to get enlightened, and we think, you know, I only thought I'd be a monk for 2 years. I thought I'd get it in 2 years. And so then after 1 year, I was a samanera the first year. That was before I met Ajahn Chah. I had a lot of insight because I did a kind of hermetic practice in a monastery in the northeast in Nong Khai province. But I also, one of the insights was I needed to train under a teacher, because I had all kinds of problems with authority figures. Like many Americans, we don't know how to cope with hierarchies or authority very well, and I could see this was one of my great weaknesses. I didn't have a clue of how to live and serve somebody else. And I wanted to be able to do this. So it was through a series of seeming coincidences that I came across Ajahn Chah, because he was not well known in Bangkok at the time, or he was becoming quite well known in the northeast, but outside of that he was not known, especially in the expatriate community in Bangkok. So he was never one figure, well, a teacher that was ever mentioned. So I found him by accident through, after my Samanera year, to met one of his monks who was traveling in the Northeast, and by coincidence, this was the only disciple Ajahn Chah had at the time who could speak English, and I couldn't speak Thai, so he came to see me. And of course, when you haven't spoken your native tongue for a year, you have this kind of diarrhea effect, you know, just couldn't stop talking. And he'd been in the Thai Navy during the Korean War, and I'd been in the American Navy during the Korean War, so we were the same age. And this kind of, and I was very impressed. He wore this color of robe, and he had a nice alms bowl, and he didn't have money, and he seemed to be incredibly strict with all these Vinaya rules. So I was impressed with this, and so eventually he convinced me I should go with him to see Ajahn Chah. And my preceptor agreed. I took higher ordination in 1967 and then went off with this monk to Wat Pa Pong. So many people want to know, what was it like when you first met him, your first meeting? What happened? And the thing I remember the most was I've been traveling all day, and I had diarrhea. And so the first thing I asked him if I could use his toilet. And so that was a good beginning. then he seemed, you know, I came at dusk. I didn't get a really good look at the monastery, but it seemed like a big jungle. But I was looking for that kind of environment. I had these ideas of what I wanted in to places that I wanted to live in, and Wat Pa Pong actually seemed suitable. And over the time that I lived with him, the people also asked, how did you learn if you couldn't speak Thai and he couldn't speak English? And the first month there was this Thai monk who could translate. And so Ajahn Chah would invite me over in the afternoons, and we could discuss, and I could tell him what I'd been doing, and he could advise me and tell me what was expected of me at his monastery. So over in the first month there was that opportunity. But after that, I had to put forth the effort to learn to speak Thai. But actually, it was through example that I really learned, because in the first year I couldn't understand all that well of what he was saying. He was at his peak. He was only about 48, I think, when I met him. And that seemed quite old at the time. Now it looks very young, actually. And I was 33, and now I'm, I was just thinking, you know, I'm 33. I was 33 then, and I'm 66 now. So that's 33 years ago. And so but he was at his kind of peak. He was, he seemed so confident and yet so relaxed and happy. And the life in the monastery had a strictness to it, but it wasn't oppressive. You didn't feel, strictness in his own right can be very suffocating and oppressive and humorless. But Lumpa Cha had great humor, and one of his great ways of teaching me was getting me to laugh at myself, because I did take myself too seriously. And I was trying too hard, and I had this goal orientation and this sense of I've got to prove myself. And during those years with Lumpa Cha, he could reflect this to me so well, all my oftentimes good intentions, but based still on a strong sense of self and the ego and this striving quality that is so common to American people. He seemed strict, but yet in a way he was relaxed. It wasn't like a strictness that caused tension. So in his presence, you didn't feel there was any strictness at all. It was all rather, you just had this sense of being at ease. He could put you at ease, and then his humor could help you to relax even more, because many people would come to him because with their problems, because they were suffering so much, and his way of getting them to relax and calm down was not particularly to say, now sit straight and concentrate on your breath, but just by talking, telling jokes, laughing, and really talking in very direct and open and loving way to everybody. So this was something that I found very useful in, because of my nature of being a goal, trying to get somewhere and trying to control everything. There's also tremendous effort to try to get rid of things, bad thoughts and impure thoughts and emotions. And Ajahn Chah could always reflect this to me, that all my efforts were based on good intentions and ideals. But this grasping, this sense of always grasping and trying too hard, was the problem. And in his way, I, just by being around him with his sense of ease with life and his acceptance of life in whatever forms or qualities or conditions it happens to appear, he seemed quite at ease with it all. So I remember when I first accepted the invitation to go to England in 1977, and Lungpa Cha came with me, and so I thought, this will be a good chance to see how Ajahn Chah fares in a foreign country, because I'd only seen him in Thailand, and by that time he was quite famous, and so everybody around him would scurry and they'd be bowing and crawling in front of him, and there was just so much respect, and everybody'd be doing everything for him all the time. And so I thought, well, you know, in Thailand, it's he probably is used to this. This is the way it's done. The cultural conditions allow this. But in England, I can't see this happening. Wonder how he will respond to being in Europe. But the wonderful relief when I realized that he was as equally relaxed in Europe as he was in Thailand. And I remember one incident was that we were flying on the Thai International Airways, and in those days they didn't have direct flight, so we took off from Bangkok and landed in Karachi, and so in Pakistan. So taking off from Pakistan, there was one of the tires of the landing that they land on, the landing gear, exploded as we took off. So then we had to land in Rome, and so there's this warning of, you know, that there's something wrong with the airplane, and that we were going to land, and that we had to take all these emergency measures. So I had to explain it all to Ajahn Chah, and had to take his teeth out, and had to strap him in, and pull the seat over his back, and he was, and all the people on the plane, Thai people, were frightened, and they were begging Ajahn Chah, please save us, you know, and he seemed quite amused by the whole procedure, you know. And I think he was expecting us to crash, you know. But anyway, what they had to do, they had to fly over the Rome airport on it low, and they could see they lowered the landing gear, and they could see what was wrong. There's only one flat tire, and so they landed. It was a bit bumpy, but nothing more than that. So then we all had to leave the airplane while they repaired it, and And so we had to, and we were the last ones off the plane. And getting off the plane, all the Thai people that had been begging Ajahn Chah to pray for them didn't say anything after that, after they were saved. They just left. They didn't even look at him. And they were all, they were all looking at the beautiful hostess. So Lumpa Cha said, see, Sumedho, he said, when they're in trouble, they come to me, but when they're not, they like the pretty women. So then we went in, and we had to get on one of these transport buses, you know, and where you stand up and you hold on to a rail. And since we were the last ones in, we were walking toward this, and where we had to enter were all women standing there. And of course, in Thailand, they've got very strict rules, and the proximity to women is very strict. So you're not supposed to stand next to them or touch them or let them touch you. So I thought, oh, I wonder what Lung Paul's going to do with this one. You know, he's going to have, if he goes in there, he's got to stand right next to these women. And so I watched him, and he kind of looked around and observed the scene. And then I saw him kind of just suddenly make up his mind, and he walked straight on to the thing and stood right next to them without any kind of feeling of mood change or disgruntlement. But it was a sign of his ability to adapt to the irregularities or the differences, because you'd think someone so conditioned, so highly conditioned by the Thai social etiquette and around monks, and then having, this was his first experience in a non-Buddhist country, and yet he had an inner sense, a wisdom to know how to respond to contingencies of all sorts. And one other incident was we'd gone Bindabat on the alms round, and he said we should go even if we don't get anything. So, and we weren't expecting anything, so we'd go out in the morning. One morning we were living in a house in London, in Hampstead, which is northwest London, and we're coming down this street, the main street, Haverstock Hill. And as we were coming down, I was behind Ajahn Chah and the other monks behind me. There were these boys who were getting very aggressive and threatening and shaking their fists and making fun of us. And they started coming close like they were going to kick Ajahn Chah. And so I was kind of getting myself prepared. I didn't quite know what I was going to do, but I was, you know, I was very quite distressed by this myself. And so anyway, I was wondering, what should I do, you know? And I was trying to be as close to Ajahn Chah as possible. And then suddenly they left. These boys just left. And I don't know what happened. Maybe the police came or what, I don't know. But anyway, they disappeared. And so I rushed around to Lung Po Cha. And I noticed he was smiling. And I said, did that bother you? And he said, very interesting, very good Dhamma. So this was to see the way he could relate. And in England, for example, he didn't just seek the company of Thai people. He really wanted to know the English. So he was quite open and interested in everything that was going on. And it was very interesting to travel with him, because he would be seeing things in a way that would be new to me. Because even though I'd never lived in England, it was still close enough to my own background here, cultural background, that it wasn't, you know, I could easily fit into it. But for someone who came from northeast Thailand and from Thai Forest Monastery and into a big city like London, He also, we took him to Paris, and he remained the same. And he could, he, you know, but he was so interested in the way people walked or looked, and he kept noticing how fast everybody walked. And he, and I remember we were up in Edinburgh, and he kept looking at these old people, and they were walking along the street, kind of rapidly, kind of pushing themselves along the street. He says, even the old people here walk too fast. Now, I wouldn't have really noticed that, but. And then he would look at Edinburgh and he says, Stone City. Because all the buildings are made out of stone. And he would pick up on the kind of things that were kind of completely new to him. And seeing like from a mind of someone who hadn't any kind of biases or prejudices or preconceptions. In personal ways of training, he would get me to look at. He had a very good way of getting me to pay attention to myself, and so in many cases I learned a lot just through his skill in getting me to look. We'd start in the evening and have an evening puja, and then he'd get on the high seat. And he'd expound Dhamma for 3 or 4 hours sometimes, and the Thai etiquette is so strict. You're supposed to sit like this all the time when you're listening to a Desana with 1 foot out, and you're not supposed to sit in this Samadhi style. So this is very strict, and so I found this way of sitting for I could bear about 5 minutes of it, and then it would be excruciating. So then I'd sit in the Samadhi style, and then the monk next to me would say, no, you can't do that. Be on my back end, so I'd have to get back into this one. And so this would bring up such anger and resentment, you know, being pressured and the pain, with pain. And then the way the Thai monks would always be correcting me. I couldn't do anything right. And so they were always at me and kind of, I felt, making fun of me sometimes, laughing. And this would bring up such anger and rage. And then Lungpo Cha would go on, and I couldn't understand. After a while, I'd even give up trying to understand. And he would be speaking usually in the Lao, Isan dialect. So I just learned to turn off to this sound. And he said, your practice now is patience. He said, you're not very patient. And I agreed. No, couldn't deny that. But so I did. I took that quite seriously. When I asked her if I thought in a reasonable way that I think, because I am a very reasonable person, I said, Ajahn Chah, since I don't understand the language that well, I think I'd benefit more if when you gave your talks, I left the sala and went back to my kuti and practice meditation. Seemed very reasonable. And he said, no. He was being unreasonable, I thought. That's not being reasonable. But anyway, I did what he said and developed patience. And it was interesting to see, because he could... You know, when you're in pain and you're bored, you know, these are all such negative experiences, and you're frustrated because you can't understand, and everybody else seems to be fully appreciating, people be laughing, and he was a brilliant speaker, you know, but if you can't understand what he's saying, you can't feel all the time this frustration. And they were all enjoying it, and I'd feel hatred towards all of them. Feel like just, you know, the thought, I'm going to leave. I'm not going to put up with this any longer. And I've had enough. And all these thoughts would be going through my mind. But then I remember one specific time I was so angry, and he'd been going on for ages. And then suddenly he finishes, and then he looks at me and he... And he smiles and he says, how are you, tomato? And, and he said it in such a way that all the anger suddenly just dropped, you know, just completely disappeared. And this rage and resentment completely dropped, and I felt this joy that he just he gave me this sense of love and joy, and how quickly that anger that had been going on for several hours just disappeared. It surprised me because I thought if I'm this angry, it's going to take ages to settle down. But just that the way I could reflect on that. Another time, I was telling the teachers about every fortnight we do the Patimokkha recitation. It's a chanting a Pali of these rules, 227 rules. So it takes a while, you know, 40, 50 minutes. And one monk will chant the whole thing and the rest of us sit and listen to it. So this was, I remember one time he had a very good friend, an old monk, who lived quite as a hermit, Ajahn Chah-lui. And Ajahn Chah-lui was a nice old monk, but he was really garrulous person, you know, and he'd just talk and talk and talk. And so after the Patimokkha, usually we're dismissed and we can go we meet with the lay people for sitting up in the practicing meditation all night. At that time, Lungpo Cha and Ajahn Chah-lui didn't dismiss us, and they sat there talking and they were telling jokes and they were laughing and they were just going on, and I kept watching, you know, the clock and what time. When are they going to? And I was getting more and more nervous. And so during this time, I was experiencing this impatience and this thing. They're just talking rubbish. You know, none of this. It's all silly. It's not even good Dhamma, you know. And they're wasting my time. And all these thoughts would arise. And then I started hating Ajahn Chah-lui for being so garrulous. And I thought, why can't Ajahn Chah just, you know, this is not, we could all be in the sala meditating with the lay people like we should be doing. But through this, you know, I could see he was noticing me, and obviously my way of, my demeanor was obvious to him. And he kept us sitting there till about 3 a.m. And the thing that I remember about this was that it actually, by the time he did dismiss us, this had all dropped away, and I was sitting there completely at peace with it. You know, the whole negative aramana and mood had completely vanished, and I was content. And I noticed this, that actually this was, that all this impatience and rage and anger, how fleeting it is, and how, you know, if you're willing to patiently endure it, how it drops. And when you let something, when you're willing to endure pain and emotional anguish and resistance and rage and so forth, it will, and just be letting it be and not trying to struggle with it, then it drops, it ceases. And that cessation then of that mood is very, very peaceful. Very, very calm and very, quite blissful. So this is like living. I knew this in theory, you know, according to the teaching, but in actual reality of that experience, then this was quite powerful way of teaching, because he would put you in positions and difficulties just to, for, you know, in a way you were, you know, I could feel you know, that I didn't want, and you know, I kept trying to get away many times, trying to live life on my own terms. I wanted to be a hermit, and I didn't want to have to live and be under all this, where I just had to to put up with the behavior of others. And yet with this, under Ajahn Chah, I found that I actually was learning how more and more patience, and this reflectiveness, learning from the way things are, but not on my own terms. I had to let go of my own views, opinions, desires. And in this conformity, within the restraint and of monastic discipline of Thai forest tradition, and with a very strong and admirable teacher like Lungpa Cha, I was quite willing to learn. Many times I wanted to run away. The voice would say, I've had enough of this. I'm leaving. I'm not going to take this anymore. And I could see even my desire. The way I'm going to get even with Ajahn Chah is I'm going to leave. That'll break his heart, I'm sure. So I think my time is up, and offer this as a contribution to this celebration of Lungpa Cha.